Good afternoon. Today is Tuesday, March 20th, 2018. We are at Vets Hall in Morro Bay. This is the regularly scheduled March meeting of the Citizens Finance Advisory Committee. All members are present except for John Irwin, so we have a quorum present. Therefore, I'll call the meeting to order. We'll have a short moment of silence, please. Okay, let's rise for the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, meeting is called to order. I'll open it up for public comment on anything not on the agenda or that for which you cannot stay. Seeing none, close public comment. And that brings us to A1, the consent calendar. That is the approval of the minutes for the February 20th, 2018 meeting. I want to thank my vice chair, John Martin, for chairing that meeting in my absence. And I didn't have any correction of the minutes. Are there any other corrections, comments, or can I entertain a motion to approve? Okay, so can I have a motion then, unless you have a
comment? I'll move to approve.
Okay, second, I'll second.
Second.
Okay, Dave second, thank you. All right, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. That was consent calendar minutes from last month's meeting, A1. Please note all members are in attendance now. John Irwin is also here. Thank you. Item B1, brief finance department update on OpenGov and the CSMFO. That will be conducted by the finance director, Jennifer Calway. Jennifer, I can turn it over to you.
Thank you. Just wanted to continue our updates on OpenGov. We've gotten the chart of accounts uploaded at this point, and three-quarters-ish of the historical data. I thought we'd have it all updated, but I got impatient over the weekend with the last final one. So we're having to do it month by month for the last 5 years. So we're doing, you know, like 60 different reports that, they'll finish today. So I guess we're uploaded. Thank you, Val. So we're all uploaded, and now they'll put that in the portal, and we'll start going through and reviewing to make sure it's been updated accurately and start generating the reports and getting the training. So we hope to be live within about a month for OpenGov. And we'll have, that should be about the time of our next meeting. So the idea is as we go into budget, that'll be kind of done, and we'll be able to focus on budget, the budget hearings and that sort of thing. And then for CSMFO, we just wanted to discuss a little bit with the committee what we learned at the conference. Val and I both attended. We heard some great seminars on sales tax and trends with sales tax. So we know the brick-and-mortar shops are not as fruitful as they once were unless there's another kind of attraction that's bringing people out. So we heard an interesting presentation from the president of Westfield Shopping Malls and how they're kind of revitalizing the shopping malls into kind of mini town centers to bring people out. So gyms, grocery stores, medical facilities, and a lot of restaurants, mm-hmm. and a few stores to kind of bring people to those. Also heard, met with our APERS actuary one-on-one, and had some conversation with them about different options, and we're continuing those conversations to make some recommendations within the next month or so on actions we can take that would best suit our situation here and in our cash reserves. And then I thought I'd let, this was Val's first time attending, so I thought I'd let her share with you a little bit on what her experience was.
Go ahead, Val. Welcome.
Thank you. I was really, really honored to have Jen invite me and bring me in as part of that trip. It was very, very informative. Definitely as someone who's pretty new to government, put together a lot of pieces for me of things I've been working on and just making sense of the bigger picture of what I'm doing here and where I fit in. And, yeah, we talked a lot about pension. That was a big topic. So I know what we're up against. And but, yeah, it was really fun as well as informative.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So, Jennifer, before we move on, for the public's benefit, the first thing was the OpenGov and the software system, and you're already using some of that in the reports I've seen, so, right?
No, we haven't been using the portal yet. Been discussing our progress and getting everything updated in the biweekly manager's memo. Everything that we're reporting so far is kind of self-derived out of the finance
new
department.
New world, okay. So when do you expect that to be up and running and on the website so that the public could see it if they so desire? Or do you have a date yet? Is it still being implemented?
I think we have the data uploaded now, so that's great. We have to go through the one custom report's going to be on the wharf, so we'll work with them on that next to get that developed. Have some training so we know how to run additional reports. Mm-hmm. So hopefully within a month we'll have finished that, and then we'll be able to roll out for the community and have some kind of discussion here on what training and, you know, maybe work through that and how we want to roll it out for the public.
Right. Okay, so basically you can't just flip a switch and turn it on and run reports like any other system most of us have used, but you're making progress, and in a couple months we'll all be able to benefit from it, hopefully. Thank you for that. And then on the conference, is there typically any kind of trip report or summary or anything else done?
No, not that I'm aware of, and there hasn't been in other jurisdictions. I just we kind of reported out in the weekly manager's memo that went out last week. But given the timing of this, thought it would be nice to have Belle kind of report on her experience and what we learned.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. All right, thank you.
I just have a
ahead, Don.
So there is a typo in the minutes under business item C saying Council Member Irwin.
I'm sorry?
There is a typo in the minutes that I found.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I knew it was there. It took me a second to find it, but under business items number 3, Committee Member Addis, blah, 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 Council Member Irwin.
Asked about that, yes. Oh, it shouldn't be Council Member.
Right,
it
just
should be
committee member. But I actually had a super... Just very, very briefly, if there were any major takeaways from the workshop that you attended on PERS that we don't... I mean, we already know it's, you know, doom and gloom, but any other takeaways?
So I would say both in our one-on-one session with the actuary, and there were several larger-scale sessions that, you know, the whole conference attendance was invited to... PERS is really messaging that they want to work with communities on a one-on-one basis because everybody's solution is a little bit different. It depends on your cash needs or your cash flow, your reserve levels. There's so many variable factors, and the options are very different from a 115 trust to a fresh start option where you'd pay it down in 15 or 20 years instead of the 30, or selecting an individual basis. So there's about 8 different bases that go into our rates, and you can pick just one of those and pay that off, and it'll change your rates going forward. So I think that's the message everybody heard loud and clear, is we want to work with you. They did talk about the future changes with the prospectively changing the period to 20 years for new basis going forward. We don't really have a good sense of what that means because we don't know what those bases are yet, but there was some conversation about that. And they did have their whole kind of executive team there, so the chief actuary, the CFO, the CEO, all there and available and taking questions and criticism as it came. So in addition to that, Valerie and Sandy just attended a PERS workshop down in Solving. I think that was that last week now. And Bartel, who is, it wasn't John Bartel, but Bartel and Associates, that's an actuary up in the actuarial firm in the Bay Area. One of their employees came down and gave a presentation, and maybe Sandy or Val might want to elaborate a little bit more on that, but I'm not sure it was anything new. I think it was just kind of reiterating what we already had heard.
Yeah, I think it was really similar that the message, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all solution for every city or every town, and just that going over the different options and picking and choosing what works best to try to tackle this.
Thank you. Any other comments from? Right, thank you for that update. And I assume if you come up with any innovative solutions or very differing strategies, you would bring it back to council and CFAC or and/or. Okay.
Yeah, it's some of that will depend on timing, of course, because of the CFAC, but we'll definitely be communicating those. And then I would suggest that maybe we rescind the motion and redo it for the minutes to add that correction.
Update the motion to approve the minutes as amended with the correction. Thank you, Dawn. All right, so that brings us to item 2 today, B2. Which is the presentation of the CAFR report. The three attachments included in your agenda packet were the CAFR report and the internal. So all of you have those to take home today. Thank you, Jennifer, for providing those. And then I guess, Jennifer, you would like to, I thought we were going to have the visitors, but unfortunately from the Poon Group, unfortunately they are not here, so.
Yeah, so I apologize for that. It was after we published on Friday that they sent a message saying there was a scheduling conflict. So the challenges of having a phone-in discussion, they will be present for the council meeting. But Sandy, you know, I first want to thank Sandy and Susan as well. The audit was well underway by the time I started, and you know, we've been kind of just finishing up since then, but Sandy and Susan really did the majority of the work on this, so I wanted to thank them for that. The audit, you know, the main takeaways for me are what do we need to do going forward? There was three recommendations in the audit. There are three significant deficiencies is how they are categorized. A significant deficiency is less serious than a material weakness, but still, you know, something we need to address. In general, you know, we agree with all three of the findings, and we've kind of outlined what our approach will be. Realistically, the first finding with accounting policies and procedures, that was in the prior year's audit as well. Just given the transitions that have occurred, you know, it wasn't realistic that was going to get addressed. So we did expect that. My biggest concern in that finding has to do with the purchasing software that we do need to get updated. We've made some changes with doing quarterly budget reports, which I think is going to be helpful. The cash balancing had already been changed. We have another person from another department come over every morning and balance our cash, so there's sufficient internal controls involved there. CityWorks is another kind of electronic portal that's being implemented, and that is in the very final stages. So we're actually getting some training on that, and that should prove to be helpful in kind of collaborating with some of those standalone systems. So we'll reevaluate at the time when that comes up. And then for policies and procedures, you know, that is a big issue, but again, it's a timing issue. So we're going to focus on that. We're going to try to get those put together, and hopefully for the next year's audit, we'll at least have a good start to that. It might not be completely fully implemented, but we will have a start with that going forward. There was also the finding about the city's finance organization. You know, that I would say is my number one goal is we need to stabilize our staffing in the finance department and have some consistency. So to me, that's an immediate yes, we concur, and we have to do that. Every time we have turnover, it delays everything from moving forward because there's a training period. There's, you know, it's not just it's our whole city system that we have to get used to, our chart of accounts. So it creates a significant delay when we have turnovers. So that's my kind of number one focus, followed by the PO system. For different reasons, but those would be the two focus. Hopefully, stabilizing the department can occur immediately. The PO system, I have gone in and kind of played around with it. It needs to have some of the background done, work uploaded to it in terms of departments and accounts and kind of the tree for that. So we'll work on that, and that's kind of an 18-19 target for me at this point. And then the third recommendation, internal controls over recording of expenditures. This one is really speaking to the accruals that we discussed when we did our Measure Q first quarter update and year-end update for 16-17. There were five larger accrual amounts that didn't get accrued back, and when the auditors did their sampling, they found the five, subsequently asked staff to go back through and sample everything and see how many more we missed. There were the handful of additional ones, some of them very minor, so they didn't have us make adjustments for those. But again, I think that speaks directly to kind of the stabilization of the department and getting staff trained and know what they're looking for. We have a separated AP system where departments are entering their own accounts payable. I think I'm kind of toying with the concept of bringing that back in. I think that might help create some better controls, is to train one person to do that and monitor it in finance. So we're looking at possibly doing that, and that would involve reorganizing responsibilities with the existing staff. So we're not thinking of hiring anybody else, but maybe kind of switching up some of the responsibilities. And then a couple of the accruals, quite frankly, you know, staff felt that they had fixed them, but it was just not understanding how the system had worked. So that was a learning process with the new staff on board, and now we know. So, you know, I agree we need to accrue everything back, and I think we've kind of resolved what happened in that year and have some plans moving forward. There were some questions that Chairwoman Spagnuolo, you submitted. Do you want me to go through those now?
Yeah, first of all, did you get any other questions from anybody else?
I went through some report myself, but
you hadn't sent it on. Okay. So I think for the it's quite an exhaustive report. And I suspect you would have had more questions maybe if we had more time. But in general, I would like to go through some of the questions because I think that may help explain to some of the committee members what we were looking for. And then we can comment on that because I think this is a very important document. I think it's excellent that the city does it. I personally agree with a lot of what I read that I understood. But I don't want to just say the committee approves it if they haven't really gone through it in detail.
So, and you know, I do want to say that the committee reviewed the CAFR last year, and you provided a lot of great recommendations for the MD&A and transmittal. And when I say we were doing this right down to the deadline to get it published in terms of the MD&A mm-hmm. and the transmittal, that's probably even an understatement. Numbers were still changing while we were writing the MD&A. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I apologize. We didn't get to take into account those considerations. We were trying to get a product done. Mm-hmm. Next year, we have our interim audit scheduled for May 30th, I think, end of May. And, you know, we're going to be more on target and have the plan is to have more time, okay. And we will accurately address those recommendations that were previously pointed out. So I do apologize for that.
Okay. No worries. I'll be happy to just go through the questions if you'd like. Everybody okay with that? Okay. So my first question was on page 19 on the CAFR report. And basically, it said the unfunded pension liability, here we go again, but this is one of the key items, for the end of last year, June 2017, was $21.7 million. But then when I went back to last year's report, that was $17.8 million. So my first question is, that's an increase of $3.8 million. That's significant, over 20%. Is that accurate, and is there any explanation for it?
It is accurate. You would expect it to go up, and you expect it to go up because we have committed promises to retirees that are either going up or down depending on what the market's doing. Mm-hmm. We're accumulating promises on a daily basis for people that are currently working. So you do expect it to go up. The $3.8 million, $1.6 million of that is safety-related, and $2.2 million is for the miscellaneous classifications. That's where you know the 3.8 comes from. It's primarily attributed to the interest. These numbers for the report are based off the state pool as a whole, and we're allocated what our percentage is with respect to the state pool and an interest rate. So when we went back, when this question came in, we went back and looked at the supporting documentation, and it all boiled down primarily to interest.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't. You may have to slow this down. The discount rate didn't change until last fall, right? Which is after this fiscal. So, are you talking about lowering the discount rate from the 7.65 or whatever it was, a percent, as was talked about, or is this interest on some investments?
This is the city's share of the interest.
Okay.
For the whole state pool. So that kind of leads into your next question about the 7.65% that they referenced. The state pool has the 7.5% interest rate that we all refer to and know is assigned to us in Morro Bay and every other city that's changing. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, there's a 15 basis points for admin expenses that the state assigns to the pool.
Oh, okay.
So all of these numbers take into account a 7.65% rate for that administration.
Okay, so when we're always hearing that it was 7.5%, may go down to 6.5%, you still have to tack on another 0.15%, right, for the admin?
That's for this reporting.
Okay.
That's for
okay.
the governmental reporting piece of it. If you pull our specific actuarial report, the rate is 7.5%, and we'll start incrementing down.
Okay.
But
okay.
when we go to do GASB 68 and the kind of the governmental accounting piece of it, they tack on an admin,
okay.
and it's 15
okay.
basis points.
That's why you see those different percents.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that was a little confusing. Interesting. So what do we think it's going to be the next year? If it went up $3.8 million from the previous fiscal year to the last fiscal year being audited, how much more is that going to go up next? Do we have any clue, idea?
I don't have a specific number,
okay.
but I would
okay.
expect it to go up more than that because the rate's going to go down.
Okay, okay. All right, so this is serious. All right. Okay, so
may I ask a quick question?
Yeah, go ahead on that one. Yeah.
I'm just, kind of sitting here as a layman saying, is it take 7.5% return in order to keep the system solvent? What?
7.5 is the expect. Go ahead.
So the actuarials base our rates off of what they expect the return mm-hmm. to be, the investment returns to be. They use I think it's 7-year average. I might be wrong on the number of years, but they use an average over a period of time.
Yeah.
And at one point when we were overfunded, way back when, that brought our average up quite a bit because they were earning like 20% interest. I mean, it was a huge number. And then we started going into these, 0% kind of times. So that's why they're lowering the interest down from 7.5% to 7%, and they're phasing that in. The discussion is that we think that's still too high, but cities can't really absorb any more than that because every time they lower the interest rates down, it causes our liabilities to go up and what we owe them to go up. So PERS is trying to make the fund stable. They feel 7% is a reasonable estimate based on those averages. So at this point, they're comfortable and they're not going below the 7%, but at one point they were talking about 6.5%.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So then I think page 68. The next question I had was on page 74. So what is that chart saying with respect to the liability? The explanation on the next two pages was very difficult to understand. It was the actuarial. I don't know that you expect us to comprehend that, but I would hope somebody from the staff understands that. And specifically on page 74, when it talks about the net change, the pension liability and the fiduciary, then it subtracts those numbers for the plan. It would seem to me you would add them, but I couldn't figure it out.
So what I think the important takeaway from the chart on page 74, plan total pension liability, that is those numbers, $43.4 million, is how much our plan, what our liability is as of 6/30/16. Plan fiduciary net position, that's the market value of our assets that we have in the plan. So if we cashed out, that's how much we have.
So the market value went down, so in addition to the shortfall, you have to...
Right.
Okay.
And then the net pension liability, that's the difference between those two columns. So mm-hmm. that's when you hear that UAL, unfunded accrued liability. Mm-hmm. That's what that amount is. So if we had to pay everything out today, you know, that we've promised, we would be $11.7 million short.
Okay. And you liquidated, and because the market was down or didn't
right.
reach that 7.5 anticipated rate of return. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Did you understand, though, the explanation on pages 75 to 77? Did someone look at that?
We read it as much as, you know, it's an actuarial explanation, but that is summed up. That's what you get to, is we're underfunded by, you know, $12 million in the okay. miscellaneous and $10 million in the safety.
Thank you. Also, on page 77, what are the post-retirement benefits specifically? Is that health benefits, or what is that?
Retiree health.
Retiree health, okay. Mm-hmm. And they pay a portion of that, and then the rest of it, the retirees pay a portion of that, and the rest is... funded by the city or the pension fund.
That's correct. I'm not sure what the portion is the retirees pay, but
okay. When it said other benefits, it was little. Okay. Questions, John?
Yeah, Jennifer, is that money in an irrevocable trust, the OPEB money?
Yes,
is it with
ICMA?
ICMA. Okay.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, so page 85. This has to deal more with budgeting and that. Notes to the basic financial statements. And it looks like in the general fund, specifically admin, fire, and public works, that the expenditures were significantly over the appropriations. So is there an explanation for that? I thought we would be doing like mid-year budget and moving things around. Or
so some of when Sandy has gone through in the detail of what appears to have been allocated into those categories that wasn't budgeted for mm-hmm. and there wasn't an adjustment. Some of them are related to legal fees for somebody outside of our city attorney for personnel-related events that came up. There's a variety of expenditures that came up. I can't tell you why there wasn't a budget adjustment for those. Mm-hmm. You know, wasn't here. What I can tell you is that we are having conversations internally about what our budget expectations are, practices are, and mm-hmm. what they are going forward. Mm-hmm. And this came up at the last council meeting as well. And so we're having those conversations so that as the city staff, we're all on the same page. Mm-hmm. We're going to have those conversations with the council and the committee as we get into budget hearings so that we're all on the same page as understanding of mm-hmm. what do you need to go back for a budget adjustment for, what is a budget transfer, where does the city staff have authority, you know, to transfer between line items versus adding new appropriations. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, the past is the past. I have a lot of answers mm-hmm. for that. But going forward, we're all getting on the same page as to what we mm-hmm. expect.
Thank you. And I'm not trying to, you know, admonish anybody for what's gone on in the past as well as all the different personnel, but it was always my understanding, typically within a department, you can move funds around as long as you do the correct paperwork. But then outside departments, you know, adjustments over a certain amount, I would expect would go back to either city manager or city council, depending on the size. So that's why I'm kind of surprised when I see an auditor and these significant. It almost begs the question, you know, what are the consequences of overrunning the budget? And I thought that's why we're having a lot of quarterly and mid-year reviews so that we can get these. So it sounds like you have the same goal as what I would recommend based on reviewing this. Go ahead, John.
I question for you. And you were here last year, so appreciate that. But was part of the problem that the department managers were not getting the necessary feedback from finance in regards to where they were in their budget for, you know, at any particular point of the year? Or were they getting timely reports that showed them that they were over budget year to date, so to speak?
So I'll let Sandy weigh in here in a minute. But, I mean, there was a mid-year done last year, so there was conversation with that. And we have three department heads here that if they're welcome to add in if they'd like to. I think there's been some departments do a really great job of going on and tracking their own department budgets and pulling it on a regular basis. Some departments hadn't been shown how to do that or didn't either transitions at their department levels. They lost that somewhere along the way. Now we are doing those first quarter reports, so that involves a conversation with all the departments. We had conversation with mid-year, and we'll have conversation with third quarter. So we're tracking it more closely in finance, but the expectation still is departments need to track that as well. So there's that kind of double check on it. But Sandy can add if she'd like.
What I observed is that all directors and managers had access in our new world accounting system to run their own budget performance reports. And there was not an expectation that we would generate those reports and send them to them and highlight where they're over or anything, but it was their, you know, that was what they were supposed to be monitoring. But I believe that, you know, probably what gets measured gets done, and probably if there was a specific action step out of finance where you generated that report, sent it out, pointed out where they were over, it probably would bring more focus to looking at those variances and taking action. But in the past, no, there was not an obligation by finance to send those reports out.
Has there ever been any thought about doing a monthly budget, you know, a planning, a spending plan, so to speak? So the way it's done now is you do these quarterly reports and you really are just comparing this year to last year and then making judgments about whether a budget amendment is needed based on any variances between the 2 years. But there's no analysis of this is where we are at 6 months compared to where we think we should be after 6 months. There's no monthly spending plan in the budget as far as I can tell.
We don't spread the budget. I don't know if that, when you think about some of our contract services, spreading the budget between months wouldn't really be realistic because you might pay them all out at the end of the contract or in installments throughout, depending on when there are different performance metrics. I think we can do a better job, and what we're going to try to do is more monthly monitoring. So once the PO system is up, you'll have money encumbered, so that will kind of be set aside and know it's spent. And I think that will help with where are we compared to where we thought we should be. And as we generate these reports monthly, because even if the my philosophy is even if the departments are responsible for monitoring that, and they should be, finance is ultimately responsible for making sure we stay within what the council has appropriated. So at the end of the day, it's on us, and we need to do that on a regular basis. The quarterly reports we're providing to the committee and the council, they do compare trends, right? And that's kind of how we know where we're doing. But on a monthly basis, the conversation should be very different, and it should be, does this make sense for where we are in the first month of the year? Does this make sense to where we are in the eighth month of the year? So I think we can improve on that, and we're working towards that.
It's understood that expenses don't happen the same all through the year, and we know revenues don't come in the same all during the year, and capital outlays are really hit and miss. But does your software at least give you that capability? Can you program a budget quarterly or monthly, or does it not have that capability?
The software that would allow us to spread it monthly, or we can spread it monthly based on a percentage, based on historical spending from the prior year. You know, if 75% of it was spent in the first month, you know, the budget could be spread to put it in the first month. Those kinds of spreads could happen. They have not in the past spread the budget monthly because they didn't feel like it was really a significant comparison because of the timing of things come in lumps and payments go out in concentrated periods of time. But they always did a mid-year comparison to look at where they were at mid-year and be able to project, if this is where I am at mid-year, do I expect that I can maintain this spending pattern through the rest of the year and come in, you know, by the end of the year? I know that was done last year, you know, by all the directors, and brought, I think that was brought to the city council.
I can tell you, we've had this discussion for years on CFAC, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, on the encumbrance accounting and the, at the time, inability of the system to easily track those commitments and that. So I suspect it was done at the department level from what I understand. John?
My experience doing budgets and tracking expenses and stuff, unless you know what the contracts and mm-hmm. are for what the expenditures are, you're not going to be able to come up with a rational expenditure plan or whatever you want to call it to compare expenditures to get. And seeing how the Corps can never quite figure that out, and they had a lot of money to spend, I don't think we're the best we can ever hope is either a straight line or a lump sum somewhere.
Thank you. I'm not sure I agree with that. Somebody is managing those contracts, and it's just a matter of maybe finance is the facilitator for helping them and raising the flags, but whoever is responsible should be managing that.
There's outside forces involving expenditures, so it's a wag.
And some of those things are easier to predict than others, like yeah. personnel costs should be pretty easy to do, but capital outlay is the tough one. Mm-hmm. But what happens is, of course, department managers, you're aware of being in government, that they get toward the end of the fiscal year and they don't want to leave money on the table. So, you know, if they need some supplies, they don't want to burden next year's budget if they think they have money this year. And if they don't, if they're not given the right numbers toward the end of the year, they could conceivably overspend accidentally. And that's just really the line of my inquiry. Could that have happened?
The way I handled that situation was we had a priority list of, okay, how much money do we have that available for that year, and what priorities do we have? And you go A, B, C, D until you get to the bottom there, and then you spend the money on those priorities. And that way you always get what you need, and if you need more, you got to wait till the next year, but at least you always have an appropriate expenditure to use on it.
Go ahead, Jen.
If I could just clarify a little bit, if the two largest categories here that are over their appropriation amount, one of them has to do with a large transfer to the unfunded compensated absences that wasn't budgeted. So it wasn't so much that there was money left on the table that they felt they could spend. It just transferred into another fund. And then the other one was related to legal services for personnel-related matters. So again, not so much that they're trying to spend the money that they think mm-hmm. they might have, kind of unexpected, in the case of legal services, you know, unexpected costs, and then the transfer from the general fund to the uncompensated absences fund.
What happened with that compensated absences issue?
What happened?
Well, there was money that was transferred for compensated absences liability.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that happen? Why did it increase so much during the fiscal year?
I know that they transferred $466,000 into the compensable unfunded compensable leave fund, trying to start funding if, you know, no one's at, not everyone's going to resign or leave at the same time. But as everybody builds sick leave and vacation time, there's payouts that have to be made at the time of termination. And so I think there was a sentiment at that time that they wanted to start building a fund to be able to pay those out, you know, if we had a lot of retirements. And we did have a lot of retirements during 16-17. At 12/31/16, we had 8 or 9 people retire because of retirement incentives. So out of that $466,000 that was set over in that fund, about $236,000 was paid out due to retirement incentives and vacation and sick leave and severances. So it wasn't overspent. There's money still in the fund, but that's why they wanted to take it out of the general fund and set it over in that separate fund, so it was sitting there, so it didn't look like the general fund had more money.
Mm-hmm. So when you say
a discretionary spending.
When you say they, this was a council action?
This was a council action, and it was resolution 72-16 on October 25th, 2016.
I remember Buckingham discussing this at one point. Mm-hmm. It was up to $600K in that plus.
Yeah.
So it was, that's, they wanted to segregate it.
Let me, I'm sorry, go ahead.
One comment and then a question. The comment on this budgeting by month, I thought when John Martin asked the question last year, one of his first questions had to do with this monthly budgeting capability. And I thought we'd heard the software didn't have that ability. Whether it was or wasn't said then, we now understand it could be done. You have a few options, one of which is using the percentages of how it was spent the previous year. I guess you could overwrite that with what you think is going to happen, straight line or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you can do it. So then the issue gets into, is it worth it? But I'm hearing that you could do it. I'm not sure how many options you've got.
Yeah, and I can't sit here and say what the options are in the software.
So it could be done, whether or not, Jen, you think there's any value. I think you're basically saying the answer I've heard is there's not a lot of value to inputting that much detail. It is what it is. But it's just something to think about. But if that's not causing variance difference, then that's fine. My question, though, has to do with budget transfers. I'm personally a little skeptical. It's like rescheduling a project. You can always be on schedule if you keep changing things. I don't have a problem personally. We put a budget in place for the year, let it go. If you start making, if I understood what you meant by budget transfers, if you're saying, oh, we're overspending here and underspending here, so let's move some budget money, I personally don't think that's the way we ought to do it. You look at that at the end of the year and say, okay, we missed it. You want to manage to the bottom line, but as soon as you start, if what you meant to be saying is the example I just used, I would personally, again, be against it. I think we ought to just let it go. If you overrun something, you make a note saying we're overrunning it and we're underrunning here, so we think we're going to be okay. But if hopefully that's not what you meant by a budget transfer, is to mask where we didn't estimate as well as we could have for whatever reason. Things happen.
So let's use the case of legal services. Something happens and a department incurs more legal fees than expected. There may be a situation where city manager, finance director, somebody says you need to absorb that in your budget. We're not giving you extra money for it. You need to figure out where you can pay for it from. The general philosophy would be for operating costs that are not personnel related, you can absorb it within your operating line items. We wouldn't generally do a transfer. Bottom line, you're good, you're good. In some cases, if it's a large dollar amount, departments have a really hard time knowing where they've taken their money from to help balance that out. So in order to help them do that, we would do a transfer. Not because we want to say, oh, we missed the mark and kind of cover it up, but just to help them track. I know I took $2,000 from my supplies line. I took $3,000 from training materials. If a department's really struggling with trying to figure where they're going to balance that from, we'll do it for them on paper so they can see it. We don't do transfers typically between departments, so Public Works can't borrow from fire. You know, it's all within your department, within your line items. I don't like to, we don't usually allow transfers for, from personnel-related expenditure line items to operating, unless it's a matter of we have a vacancy we can't fill, so we're hiring a consultant to do that work. That would be okay. But you don't use personnel savings for supplies and materials. We make that differentiation for the departments, or we are making that differentiation for the departments. And the reasoning is when you approve your budget, you approve a budget by department for personnel costs. So that is what you're saying for Public Works, it's $2 million for personnel costs. So they have to spend that on personnel-related costs, or we have to come back to the council and ask for a budget adjustment.
You used a very sensitive example of legal costs, as you know, which is maybe another discussion that, again, I'm hoping we're going to have a lot more visibility to legal costs. But I'd say that brings up a whole, opens up a whole can of worms to start talking about how some legal cost is causing possible some of this issue we're talking about. So I don't want to get into that now, but that caused me a little alarm that legal cost. If legal cost is part of running the department, it ought to be there. Or we put legal cost as a line item, which is kind of where I'd like to have it go.
Yeah.
But so you're saying you don't, you definitely don't transfer between departments. I guess between a contract and straight staff, you might say that would balance out. But again, let it go and just say at the end of the year, we overspent a contract because we got a contractor to do what we thought the labor was going to do. So,
okay, noted. Can we move on? Page 90, what's included in other revenues? That was another one that was a little off the mark, so I was just kind of curious. The budget amount was $344. The final amount was $911,000.
So there's a couple of items here. The $911,000 includes the budget for our solar installation. When solar was installed on the City Hall and I think the Public Works building, that budget number is included in the 911. It's not included in the expenditure. It should have been classified differently. The other piece is there's $338,000 that's categorized as personnel vacancy rate. I can't tell you why that's listed as other revenue. I would have thought it would have showed up as an offset to personnel costs in some way or another if it's a personnel vacancy rate.
The what? Personnel vacancy rate? Oh, personnel. Okay. All right. I got it. So somebody left and you didn't fill the position. And,
right.
Okay,
so there's
gotcha.
There's a vacancy factor that's built into the budget. And the 338 was the vacancy factor
for
16-17.
Okay, you just pushed that back in. Okay, that explains it. Thank you. I also noticed on page 63 we had an asset called artwork valued at $63,000. I was just kind of curious where that artwork might be.
$60,000 is for the rock at Morro Bay Boulevard, the stonework, I'm sorry, from 2006, and then $3,000 for the art anchor structure that was done in 1996 down at Tidelands Park.
Okay, that's very good. Thank you. I'm just kind of curious, you know, look around here, and I didn't see too much, so thank you. And then that takes, let's see, I had a question on 143. Why the big drop in the state water contract expense, $2.6 million the previous fiscal year to $1.6 million? And that was on page, I think, 143 of the CAFR report. That would be about a third of the way down.
Yes, I see it. It's about midway through the page under operating expenses, state water contract maintenance.
Right.
The $1.6 million for 16-17, there was an $830,000 prepaid. Well, we, of all the expenditures that we paid during the year for state water, me get the right number. 803,000 was prepaid for the next year for 17-18, and so we accounted for it correctly in the 16-17, and it was not accounted for. There was no prepaid removed from the 15-16 number of 2.6, and I'm not quite sure why they didn't identify that in the audit and correct that. You know, maybe. I don't know why, but that's why your number is lower in 16-17 is because 803,000 is prepaid for the future year.
So what do you think it's going to be next year? Then it'll go back up? Who knows?
I have no idea. But that prepaid will come back into expense in 17-18 because it'll be in the proper year. But every year there will probably be a prepaid because we pay that well in advance of, they bill us well in advance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Public comment opened?
Maybe just add to the, so we receive the bills for the entire year for the fixed costs at the beginning of the year and prepay the next fiscal year at that time. State water costs remain fairly constant. There's a fixed portion and a maintenance portion. The maintenance portion is the portion with an escalator on it. Roughly, we've calculated about 5% per year that the state water will go up. But it's running somewhere under about $2 million a year for our state water, project water.
So you get it at the beginning of the calendar year is
what
you're saying.
We get it at the beginning of the calendar year for...
kind of like two payments.
They bill on calendar year basis. Okay. We pay on fiscal year basis.
Okay.
So if there's a fixed portion and a variable portion of the bill.
Right.
So why was there a variance between one year and the next?
Because we prepaid the next year and noted it in the budget one year, and we accrued all those costs, even the following year's cost, to that previous year.
But if the bill's due in January?
The bill is due in
or December.
January and July, and we typically get the bill in January, so we prepay so that it gets accounted for in that next fiscal year.
So I'm still not understanding how, if you're paying in January of each year, which falls in the middle of the fiscal year, how does that become a prepay that's different from one year to the next? It seems like it would be the same every single year.
It would be if it were accounted for a prepay in every single year. But the previous fiscal year wasn't accounded for as a prepay.
I see. Okay. Thank
that's
you.
That's what she said.
I'm sorry.
Said
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's all I have on the CAFR. Any other questions, comments? Go ahead, John.
Thank you. Most of my stuff is in that introductory section, and page 8 seems to have a lot of it. Long-term challenges. First thing I ran to was second bullet, second sentence, and it said... something to the effect. Then funding in the amount of 1.5 would be needed to maintain. I would probably want to change that in future years when you write that up as estimated. As we go through this payment maintenance plan, as we find out what's actually out there, the numbers are going to squirm around a little bit, and hopefully we come up with some methods of repair which are considerably cheaper than the standard possibility. And Rob's quite well aware of what can change in those payment management program as we go along with it. Another comment was we probably should have a section in long-term challenges that... one of the reasons why we're doing this wastewater recycle facility is that while the city has not kept up with its preventive maintenance on streets, the state has not kept up with their preventive maintenance for the state water project, which, based on what Rob has said, it's going to go up a lot. And that's one of the reasons why we've been doing this wastewater recycle facility is have an option to, rather than just stay married to the state and pay whatever they tell us we have to pay, have an option to get out and control those costs better. And that probably should be clear in the long-term challenges. Another one which popped up was there probably should be a section of replacing the wastewater treatment facility, which is the other half of that reason we're doing that, wastewater reclamation facility.
I'm sorry, John, where are you reading from?
Huh?
What page?
In the introductory section.
Roman numerals.
Roman numeral 8. Under medium-term challenges, I keep hearing that we really don't have a capital replacement program. We probably ought to have some discussion about capital replacement in introductory section. And then I had a couple more things which kind of popped up while I was doing it. When I used to do budgets and project management and things, there was a term we called a risk management plan, where it can vary from the back of a napkin to way too much detail. But you go through and you say, these are the risks that we're dealing. This is why we have this much contingency. That might be something the city could use to, you know, say, this is why we have this much contingency. And you can base it on this risk management plan and whatever appropriate detail to it, but there is a way to justify contingencies that we have. And then the other thing, and then the last thing which popped in my head, it would be interesting to see what the negotiated scope for the auditors were, but I don't know if you'll be ever be able to share that with us. But thank you. That's all I had.
Okay. I think those are great recommendations that we can incorporate into the next transmittal, so thank you for those. You're certainly, the contract with the audit firm is a public document. You're certainly welcome to look at that at any time.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, John. Okay, so any further questions or comments on the CAFR report? Go ahead, Dave.
I had a question, comment on finding 217-003, which is the internal control over the recording of expenditures made subsequent to year end. It includes more than that, though. The question I have is, what's the city's policy regarding the fiscal year end cutoff for expenditures charged to that fiscal year?
So to the extent possible, we wait until September-ish and we try to get any late invoices that have come in and we accrue them back to the prior year. I'll ask Sandy to speak specifically to the direction that went out at the time. I think that came from either her or Craig, and they gave some specific instruction to the departments on what should be accrued back and what should go into the fiscal year that they were currently working in. As I mentioned, one of the problems was that staff caught, I think, 3 of the 5 in their review, and they thought they had fixed it, but they didn't match the batch number in our system to the GL number, so it didn't actually get fixed. So that was just a learning opportunity. But I'll let Sandy speak to the direction they gave at the time.
Yeah, there was a comprehensive memo that goes out at the end of every year giving direction to staff and directors as to what to watch for in invoices that come in at the end of the year. And there's a lot of variables as to what gets accrued. And an example would be if you're ordering supplies and you ordered it on June 29th, but you didn't receive it till September or July 15th, we would not accrue that because it wasn't received. But if it was received on June 30, but you didn't get invoiced till September 14th, we would we have to look at the date received. So there's a lot of detail that has to go into making sure you put the right expenditure in the right year. So those kinds of parameters are explained and outlined and detailed in that memo. We ask them to also contact their vendors and ask them to accelerate getting their invoices in. We do leave it open. We leave it open as long as we possibly can, usually into as open as we can until we have to send a trial balance to the auditors. We do have to cut off about mid-September, close everything out so that we can get started on the audit. But there is quite a detail. I can't recall every detail, but I can certainly provide that memo to the committee so they can see the instructions that are given. There's a lot of invoices that come through, that we process on a routine basis, and it just so happened that there was five invoices that were larger amounts. A lot of them were project related. They weren't operating expense related, and people just didn't notice that the services were rendered in the period, prior to the fiscal year closing, because they were looking at the invoice date. So that's the education we have to do with our staff and our directors. And also, it was a learning curve on the software system, because some of them were identified, thought they put it in the batch dated June 30th, but the general ledger date was still July 27th, and so it got posted in the new fiscal year. So that was a learning curve on our part.
So it would appear that your suppliers have to comply with revenue recognition rulings, and that your expense recognition would be consistent with those in general. Would that be a fair statement? They can't be recognizing revenue and you're, foregoing the pushing the expense out to another period.
Correct, because if they shipped it and it was received, yeah, they obviously would recognize it as revenue. We need to recognize it as an expense. Okay. So it can get a little, there's a lot of variables and there's a lot of different rules and people that aren't doing this all the time. If we closed the books and went on an accrual basis at the end of every month, it would give people 11 different times cutoffs to practice this. Mm-hmm. We only do this once a year. So it's pretty, we understand it, mm-hmm, but it's kind of hard, when we have a decentralized AP process to really help people be comfortable with that.
I think that memo might be nice. You could just include it in a future agenda as a receiving
file.
Sure.
Would that
be okay?
Because it certainly was outlined, and we tried to give them guidance.
Okay. Thank you.
So as I understand it, the policy is that if the goods are received or the services rendered prior to June 30th, then that the invoice for those goods or that service will be paid from that fiscal year.
That's correct.
And mm-hmm, you're holding the fiscal year close open until mid-September.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, to try to allow for people to get their invoices in that are later. We also had a retention amount on the pavement management. They didn't invoice. No, it wasn't. I'm sorry. It was on a storm drain replacement. There was a retention, and they invoiced us in August. We didn't. We had an engineer retire, I think, at the end of the last fiscal year, and no, Public Works didn't realize that project was deemed complete. And so because we didn't know it was deemed complete, we accrued, we left it in the 17-18 year, but the auditors found it, and we had to accrue it back. And that was $53,000 of the $200,000 adjustment.
Okay. So. And then the comment I would make is that in the management response, and it looks like there's an incomplete sentence there. The second sentence, as part of the organization's effort at stabilizing the staffing and structure within the finance department, an assessment of centralizing the accounts payable function within finance. That doesn't quite make sense.
On what page?
This is on page, come on, wake up. I'm looking at the staff report. I'm looking at the staff report, and it's page 10.
Thank you.
On the staff report. And this is under the management response to the recommendation on 217-003. So that second sentence doesn't look like a complete sentence, but what I'm getting out of this is that finance is considering centralizing the accounts payable function back into the finance department. Right now it's decentralized out to the various departments, so they are actually performing their own accounts payable functions against their contracts. Am I understanding that correctly? Are they like issuing checks and?
No, they don't issue the checks. They code everything and enter it into AP, and then it's reviewed in finance. So that what we're thinking about doing is just having, we'd send the invoices to the department for approval because that still needs to happen at the departmental level. But we would enter them in finance and then process from that point forward. That would be more the centralized model. Instead of having departments entering them and then us reviewing what they've entered, we would just enter them.
Would there also be some review of the contract and if the and to determine if the contract is actually open and if it has current certificates of insurance and endorsements and that the expenditure is appropriate to the contract and proper account numbers being charged and so on?
So once the PO system is updated, all of that would be in a PO or attached to a PO. So if you had an approved PO with an outstanding balance that has been encumbered, you would know that that's all current. But yes, if we bring AP back in, we need to be able to check, contracts and all of that and make sure that the work meets the contract terms, there's a balance left on the contract, they have a business license, all those checks and balances.
Before the check is actually released so that can get corrected.
Correct.
Because I know that's, from my past experience, that's many of the things that happen with contracts is insurance certificates expire. Mm-hmm. Sometimes contracts expire. So it sounds like the plan is you're going to have a purchase order covering a long form contract. Am I understanding that correctly?
I would say that's my vision right now, is to the extent that we can get all of that tied into an approved PO, that would be the most efficient way of knowing when the invoice comes in that all those criteria are met, right? So the contract was, if it needs to go to council, it was approved at the council level. They have a business license. Their certificate of insurance is valid. All that's been submitted. It's held somewhere, and whether that's the finance department, the clerk's office, or where that will be, we need to determine. It should all be attached into electronically and hopefully with the PO system, and I think our system can accommodate that through LaserFish, it's all right there. Whoever's processing AP can click on it, confirm that if they are, concerned that the contract period might have ended or something. But, yeah, the idea is for all to be linked through that PO system to the extent that we can.
So currently the contracts are essentially paper contracts. They're paper files that are being held by the departments.
The clerk is holding the more current ones. They used to be held at the department, so there's a little bit of a mix right now, but I think the clerk has the most of them at this point.
Is that because the clerk's in charge of public records, or is there a reason for that having the city clerk? The city clerk.
Well,
I assume by clerk you mean the city clerk.
City clerk, yeah. I'll speculate that it was more efficient to have one common holding place for them, so you could go to one person and pull a contract, rather than each individual department.
Okay. Okay, so the purpose of covering that contract with the PO is to get it in the electronic database for the PO system, so that it's more searchable, easier to locate, and so on.
Right. I mean, you still probably, I'm not sure if our records retention policy covers electronic storage at this point, so we may need to update that. So there might still be some paper copies, but from our perspective, I would have everything scanned into LaserFish, so it was right there for us to access.
Okay. All right. Well, I would encourage you to centralize the AP function into finance for sure, and provide some checks and balances on the payments before they actually go out against contracts.
Just to clarify, I don't want to give the impression that there's none right now, because we are reviewing it, but we're obviously missing things. So, we have some checks and balances now. I think we're, doing as good as we can do with the structure we have, but we might be able to be creative in how we redo our structure. So, I just wanted to add that I do that step on all wastewater treatment, the new wastewater treatment related contracts. I go make sure that there's an approved contract, that they're within the limits, and there is an insurance policy in place. But that's the rest of them are done at the director levels in their departments.
Well, I think the key point there is checks and balances, and having finance being the check and balance before that payment actually goes out, I think, is important.
Okay, well noted, and we may need to discuss that at a future. I want to get through all the agenda. I'm sorry, did you have something?
Yeah, I had one. Based on what David's talking about, it sounds like, is there anything that looks like a contracting officer for the city? Is there any person who looks like a contracting officer for the city, or is it spread between the various departments?
It's spread between the departments. The departments are responsible for processing their own contracts at this point, and then they get sent to the clerk's office to be held in that filing cabinet.
And who makes sure that state requirements for contracts are met? Is it the department, and then it's reviewed by somebody in the city, or is it?
We have a standard kind of contract template that we use, but the city attorney signs off on the contracts as approved to form. You know, Public Works is responsible for filing the DIR or making sure that the, you know, if it's a Public Works contract, that the contractor has their DIR number, and the departments are all responsible for that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, John. All right, anything else before we move on to B3, Measure Q? All right, so let's move on.
Jennifer, last year in the CAF, or the auditor made a couple of comments in his letter, which we had mentioned in our memo to the council. And I just want to read you a couple of them. The first one had to do with the coverage ratio for the state water payments. And it said that the city's ratio was at 116%, which is below the required minimum ratio of 125%. And we had mentioned in our memo that we thought that was something that was worthy of being mentioned somewhere in the audit, maybe in the supplementary information. But it's something that really is something I think that should be revealed to the city council every year. And this year's CAFR doesn't mention it at all. So I'm assuming there was an improvement because of the water rate increase, but as far as I know, it's not mentioned anywhere. And then the second thing that they mentioned is that they said the city's governmental activities and the Harbor Enterprise Fund had unrestricted net position deficits of $5.7 million and $0.6 million, or $608,000 respectively. Management's plans regarding those matters are described in the management discussion and analysis. And we looked for that, and of course there wasn't any mention of that in the MD&A, and so we pointed that out. But I would just mention that this year both of those deficits have deteriorated further. The governmental activities has gone down by an additional roughly $400,000. And the harbor, the unrestricted net position in the harbor enterprise fund is $989,000 compared to $608,000 last year. And if you look in the auditor's letter this year in the CAFR, those things aren't mentioned at all. So I'm curious as to if those were worthy of being mentioned last year by the auditor. Why weren't they mentioned this year? And is that something that management actually asked them to remove?
I certainly didn't ask them to remove. Quite frankly, we wouldn't have had time to ask them to remove anything because we were writing this as they were compiling these. So we were writing our piece. I mean, that wouldn't have even been an option, nor would we do that anyways. But I don't know specifically why they choose to mention some items one year or another. I can't really ask that. What we can do is bring back, when this goes to council and the council memo, it's scheduled for April 10th. I'm happy to include the coverage ratio for state water and we can talk about the deficits, talk about those points specifically from staff's perspective.
Okay, thank you, John. I thought I saw those percents in there somewhere.
I did.
123 or something? I could have sworn I saw it, but I don't know. Might have been buried in a footnote.
In some notes somewhere, but I can't remember where
yeah.
I saw it. It said
I thought it was in
we
there.
Were required to have 1.25% times the exposure for the State Water Project. And I think wherever the discussion of the State Water Project is where we're going to find that.
Maybe. Okay, anyways, moving right along, that'll take if we are finished, we'll go on to Measure Q, which is item B3. And thank you, Jennifer, for that information. So I'll open it up for public comment. Is there any public comment on item B3, Measure Q funding for the current fiscal year 2018-19? All right, seeing none, close and bring it back to the committee for discussion.
If I could just add a little bit. This is new this year. This is kind of a new step in the budget process. I don't think we've come to you in the past and asked for kind of your thoughts prior to giving you a proposed budget. Part of this is just kind of our new budget approach, and then the other part of it is that, you know, in light of the fact that the general fund is facing some pretty significant deficits and we're working towards how we're going to balance that, there may be some options or some ability to kind of change some of the funding proposed in Measure Q. The police chief has not had a chance to meet the committee since he's joined the city, and we felt that it might be useful for the committee to hear from the three departments that are impacted by Measure Q, a kind of a discussion of what their needs are, and then if the committee wants to give any feedback to us as staff as we go back and kind of get that in advance before we develop the proposed budget, keeping in mind and recognizing that, you know, it's advisory, so we'll certainly take it under advice. And we want to collaborate with you to the extent that we can. So we thought that would be useful information to have. But as we're developing the budget, you know, we'll certainly bring back what we think is the most appropriate budget for the committee to review it in April at the next committee meeting. So if it's okay, I'd like to ask the fire chief to start out, and then they just want to speak for a few minutes, each of them, on kind of the needs in their departments, and then maybe we can talk about what you would like to recommend going forward.
Okay, thank you. We have been involved somewhat in the past with the A list and B list and that, so we appreciate that. Welcome, Chief Knuckles, and go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, and you know, we got a lot to celebrate. Measure Q has made a tremendous difference in the public safety component in our community. You know, it all started from the Emergency Services Ad Hoc Committee that started in 2003. I served on that committee, and we came up with recommendations for revenue enhancements that we looked at from benefit assessment tax to all the way to sales tax. And the council at the time voted for a sales tax initiative, and it's been very well received. And what a positive difference it's made in our community. You know, the Emergency Services Ad Hoc Committee addressed four different areas in the fire department that was that needed a lot of help. One is that we needed to be able to cover simultaneous calls. At that time, if a second call came in, we would have to respond someone from home to come in and take that second call. We didn't have OSHA-mandated staffing to make interior attacks on structure fires. We had an aging fleet, and then our fire station was destroyed on Harbor Street, and we had to find a funding source to help us with that. So some statistics that the celebration that we should have, especially on the fire side, that Measure Q has done its job, and it's done, and I hope in the future also. So since 2008, that's when we increased our staffing to cover simultaneous calls. We're able to respond to over 2,500 more calls in our city when 911 was dialed at the same time. And that is a big plus. Because, again, if we had to wait for that second engine to come in from another city or people coming from home, we're talking 25, 30-minute response times, and that is catastrophe for medical aids and fires. Since 2008, we had also the opportunity to make aggressive interior attacks on 161 structure fires in our community. Also with Measure Q and the Hoag Foundation and Bertha Schultz, they all helped us get our fleet back up to where it needs to be. Also with the help of Measure Q, Cal OES, and Fire Act grant, our community was able to replace our damaged Harbor Street Fire Station right down in downtown Morro Bay. And also with the help of Measure Q and other grant funds that we have, the community was able to replace needed medical rescue and firefighting equipment that the general fund sometimes can't support, but it also enhances our service to our citizens. So some of the sample items that we have requested and have received funds since 2007 definitely is the building of the fire station 53 on Harbor Street, but also to help us with the debt service that we're making right now. The salaries and benefits to maintain four-person staffing, as we do now. We have a very creative staffing pattern. We use part-time help. Basically, we have 12 slots, 11 full-timers. We use part-time help and overtime to fill that 12th spot, vacation time, holiday time. And by some creative scheduling, it's been turned out to be the most cost-efficient way of doing it. It's helped us with fire hose replacement, generator for our MASH casualty trailer, which staffs medical equipment for 48 patients. It's helped us with repairing our Black Hill repeater, a comprehensive rewrite of our Morro Bay emergency management plan, which we're doing right now at this time. It's helped us with heavy rescue hydraulic equipment, a sustainable fuel for fire apparatus and rescue apparatus at Station 53. It's helped us establish our Morro Command frequency for our EOC, Fire Department, and Harbor Department, and also Coast Guard functions. Helped us with self-contained breathing apparatus tester. It's called a port account, so that we can test our equipment yearly without sending our equipment off. It is a cost savings measure. It's helped us with this, with our mobile data terminals. It's helped us replace command vehicle. Helped us purchase a Type 1 Pierce engine. At that time, what we did is we paid into a fund until we raised enough money, then we replaced that apparatus. It's also helped us maintain our apparatus schedule along with the Hoag grant to replace our squad, also helped us purchase an additional Type 1 engine that we use a depreciation account that was established by Measure Q. So next year, we're looking into things that is really no different than the past requests that we have done. One is, again, to help pay for the debt service that we have for the station. Also to help us with salary and benefits with part-time and full-time help to maintain our four-person staffing. Also to look at, we just did a study on our single repeater site for emergency frequencies, and we only have one on Black Hill. We used to have two, but the second one was at a private location at a cell site. We're losing the fight on that hill, so we're down to one. So we did some studies, and we found that we can place a second repeater with good coverage in our city at our fire station, which is our secondary dispatch in case of an emergency event. We also have ham radios there also. And then the fourth request is to go into a five-year payment plan for replacement of 5391. It is a 25-year-old engine. It's done a great service for the city of Morro Bay. We do have a remaining about $250,000 from the Schultz Trust that we use for a down payment to bring the payments down to a five-year payment schedule. So those are basically the four things that we're going to be looking at the fire department to request out of Measure Q, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. I have some questions. Thank you for the report. Excuse me, the report. That was excellent. And also for what was included in the agenda packet. And I was noting on the budgets versus incidents, cost per incident, Morro Bay looked like had almost the lowest budget versus incident of 1,442. So was that good last year? And specifically, what do you attribute that to? Is that the training or what?
Well, one is our creative scheduling. There's only, at this time, we're switching over a database that fire departments use nationwide.
Okay.
There's only two fire departments that use our type of scheduling, and that is us and South Bay. And so they're changing their database just to fit us. So with the use of part-time help and still trying to maintain our reserve component, that's helping us a lot. And also, we've been extremely successful with grants and givings, and I think that is probably a big factor also. We're probably 50% of our equipment and capital replacement off our schedule is we get off grants or trusts or Measure Q. That has been the greatest success, I think, also. So I think with a creative scheduling and also being very successful in grants and givings.
But the grants would still be included in the calculation, right? Or are these calculations only what comes out of the fire department budget?
It's expenses. So those are expenses that come out of the general fund.
General fund.
And Measure Q.
They only come from Measure Q. Right. So it still shows a very efficiently run. That's what I think this indicates.
And that shows right there that, you have a very efficient run fire department for the cost.
Right. Yes, absolutely. The other thing I questioned, the residents versus non-residents incidents, and it looked like two-fifths of them, based on what you know, were non-residents.
Yes.
So 40%, roughly, if we can extrapolate to the unknown calls, are coming from people that are not residents. Is that, what are they doing? What are our tourists doing that are causing all these calls?
Well, we do get a lot of visitors. You know, our population, if you look at our calls per population, we're off the chart. So we just can't go off what the population sign says on the city limits. We do get a lot of visitors. You know, I've heard sometimes between 750,000 to 1 million visitors every year we get. In the past, because right now we have a pretty clunky database, we're switching over in April. We had to do it manually, and right now we are going through and manually checking the reports, who lives out of town, who's unknown, and who does live in town. In the past, it's been roughly about 31% we can confirm that are from non-residents in our community.
And they're calling?
They're calling 911. So where they get in car accidents or they have medical aids on
it's
their
not just
there.
Fires in the motel room. It's, yeah, okay.
No,
a lot of medical aid.
A lot of medical
aid,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Comments, questions, members?
I have a question. Can you explain your plan for the five-year replacement of the fire engine?
Oh, you bet. Our plan is to first start off with a $250,000 down payment, and I will be going to the council for a single source request. We purchase Pierce engines, which are the best in the country, because we need our engines to last 20 to 25 years. Most cities, they replace their engines at 20 years. We pushed ours to 25 years because they're a good quality piece of apparatus. And then they'll be going into a five-year payment schedule. So we'll be looking at definitely working with finance and looking at all our options. But usually with Pierce Industries, they do have the lowest interest rates and best terms for us for purchasing an apparatus.
Purchase, not a lease, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, can you explain to us this chart in regards to the Morro Bay ISO rating and fire insurance? That one boggled my mind.
Well, sorry, we don't have any. I didn't get any written explanation on that. I do apologize for that. So what we have been told by the industry, insurance brokers, that there is 5 to 6% reduction in fire insurance between 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. There is a 4 to 5% reduction in residential fire insurances between 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Everything above a 5 usually doubles. In today's time, especially what occurred up in Santa Rosa and the Thomas Fire in Santa Barbara County and Ventura County, they may not even cover your facility. We went down from a 5 to a 3 about 2.5 years ago, and the factors that got us down to a 3 was getting our fire ladder truck back in service from, thank you, Bertha Schultz. Also switching over to our dispatch, which gives us 3 different methods of being dispatched, and they have multiple dispatchers in their dispatch center. That lowered our number. We've got a great water system. We've got great testing, and we also have great maintenance. So we score very high in our water maintenance, or our water portion of it, and our fire training. Also, we do get a lot of points for our fire training in addition. So right now we're at three. So if we were to, for example, let's say we make a decision to decrease our staffing again and go back to a five, there can be a 10% increase on fire insurance. If we went past a five, there's a chance that we won't be able to insure some of the buildings in our community.
Okay. And I have a question for Jennifer related to the fire. Basically, you know, the Coral property that was sold in an escrow and is going to be used to pay down the debt that he's referring to, the 15-year, we're probably in year two or three. I understood there were stipulations in that escrow about subdividing or whatever. Is that sale finalized? The proceeds were supposed to go to pay down that debt.
It's still an escrow at this point. I think it was a 36-month escrow, if I remember.
36 months?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
If I remember correctly. It was a very long escrow period. So
oh, okay. So it's still an escrow. We don't have – that affects, you know, obviously right. funding for what you're asking for. So.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a quick
– go ahead.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about the creative scheduling and the part-time person or the part-time people and how you keep consistency of practice if there's firemen or fire people, you know, rotating in and out on a part-time basis to control cost, which obviously we appreciate, or I do, from a Measure Q perspective on the cost side, but then I'm wondering how you keep that going. If there's rotating personnel that aren't a consistent part of the department, or maybe they are?
So we do have a reserve component. Right now we do have 15 members. I do have four of them right now down in Lompoc, finishing their living down there, finishing the academy, fire academy, the full-time fire academy. It is a challenge. I mean, as you probably have been hearing, what's been going on with Pismo Beach recently, getting rid of their fire reserve program. Five Cities Fire Authority being very challenged. You know, today's society doesn't really support, like when I started, it was like the Lions Club. It was doing community service. Well, today it's the apprentice program, and especially how Cal OSHA has required now hundreds of hours for each of our reserves to train. We do have to look at the cost-benefit line every year, and we have to do that every year to try to come up with a creative scheduling to get them in there. You know, by contract with the full-time staff, with MOU, basically I can run three full-time and one trained qualified reserve. Now, a qualified trained reserve may only have 10% of the training of the full-time, but that's something we tolerate right now. And my job in the next few years is trying to maintain our reserve component. There are times where I may not be able to get a reserve or one of the other full-timers are off that I do have to use my overtime budget, which is calculated, to help fill and make sure I maintain 4-0 staffing. Since 2008, when we started this, we have maintained our 4-0 staffing. The only exception is like if we had a significant event in our area and we were spending mutual aid, we may be downstaffed just for 30 minutes or so. But we have maintained our staffing since 2008 all the time.
And then do you, with the PERS piece, I don't know how that affects, I'm assuming there's a big effect or significant effect. Do you expect staffing to stay level? Well, do you expect to see changes, more part-time people?
I don't think I'm going to be able to get more part-time people, to be honest. Right now we are very grateful that we have 15 folks. We usually hire 6 a year, but we lose 6 or 7 a year. So it's kind of an up and down, peaks and valley. The average lifespan of a reserve is about 2.5 years. So on the reserve component, I'll let Jennifer talk about the PERS. We may have to address that in the future. But we're looking at the reserve program now to keep the hours down so that we can keep them out of the PERS range. Jennifer?
So PERS is going to play a big impact, you know, for fire and all our departments, really. And we're looking right now at the city has an exemption under PERS for some of our part-time, all of our part-time employees. But that's, PERS is revisiting that. So HR and Dana and Lori and have been having conversation with PERS and with our legal team. And finance is getting involved as we need to sort out classifications that are no longer exempt from PERS, even if they're part-time. So and budget those numbers too. And that's the other thing is the PARS, which was what part-timers were put into. It's a small amount, but we weren't really budgeting for that. So those are kind of conversations we're having right now, just yesterday, actually.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments for Chief Knuckles? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Chief Allen is going to speak a little bit, too, about the police.
Okay.
Needs.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Appreciate this opportunity to address you. And I just wanted to give some thoughts about our police safety and the challenges that come with keeping our community safe. So our crime prevention, our proactive community policing, and all of these things that we really enjoy in our city are due largely in part to the very hard work of the police officers behind the scenes. In spite of our staffing issues, it is that proactive police work late at night, early in the morning, that keeps our community safe and addresses many of the issues before they occur. In 2006, we had 26 sworn authorized on our police department. In 2017, we had 18, and I am currently down one position. I have 17 sworn officers, including myself and the commander. The concerns and the challenges that come with these staffing levels are many. It's very important for me and for us to ensure that we have a police staffing level that adequately can protect and serve this community. Our staffing realities now are that oftentimes on any given shift, we may have one sergeant, two officers. That is greatly impacted if we have an arrest of a homeless person as we are addressing the quality of life issues, and that homeless individual, before they're taken to jail, require medical attention. So it is very, very conceivable and often happens that if we have a person like this arrested, that officer is gone and out of the city for 3 to 5 hours sometimes as they're getting medically screened to get booked. When you add to that the other issues that may arise and the fact that our surrounding law enforcement partners are likely challenged, for instance, the Sheriff's Department has two deputies on duty from Cambria down south to wherever they go down south. I forget the boundary there. So my point is that many, many times we're left in our city with one, maybe two officers at best, patrolling and protecting our citizens and responding to calls for service. Despite that, we'll continue to be creative. Some of our strategies are forming community partnerships, community education, neighborhood watches. Training is huge. I know I don't need to remind anybody of the recent tragedies that have occurred nationwide in our schools. As early as today, Paso Robles High School was on lockdown. That has now been lifted. And, of course, we had the other incident this morning in the school. The point here is that we'll continue to do the best we can with the resources provided. I want to underscore the importance of the school resource officer, and I know for fiscal reasons that that could not continue, and I understand that. But at some point, we have to come to an understanding of how low do we allow our staffing level to get, and I need and ask for your ability to provide the adequate staffing that can protect our community effectively. I'll take any questions you have.
I have a question.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I do have one question in the material provided. Thank you. There were some police performance indicators and measures. It looked like it was just a template. Is that correct? And are you tracking some of these metrics or going to? And it looked like, even more importantly, you will have a budget associated with each, you know, like a courtesy citation issue, how many, and then I assume there'd be a cost associated with each of that. Is that what this template was for?
So we're crossing over a little bit into B4 because that was really kind of the discussion for B4.
Okay.
And those are templates.
Okay.
They're more metrics that we're asking the departments to come up with what kind of what their workload is, so we can try to
kind of measure it. Yeah.
Budget.
I think that's great if they can provide those easily without, you know, tracking it on us sticky.
Also, to clarify, those are really in draft form, so they're conceptual at this point, and they may change when you get your actual budget document, but we wanted to give the committee a chance to see where we're going.
Okay. Questions for Chief Allen?
I think it was last meeting I had asked staff if there's a way to get a comparison of cost without the SRO, since this committee voted, you know, to move that money around and to see if we actually are saving money by defunding that position, or if that money is now being spent by servicing the schools or servicing the school age population, but just by different officers. So if there's a way to find out, is it truly a cost savings, or is that money just sort of, you know, being spent by other officers for overtime or for doing those same amounts of services or for addressing crime in other ways that could have been addressed by the SRO, if that makes sense.
I'd like Jennifer to respond to that particular point, and then I'll pick up on the...
Okay. Yeah, so that was the discussion at the last council, or last committee meeting, and I think we talked about the $70,000 that was set aside in Measure Q. You know, it was truly a cost savings, except for we reallocated most of that to purchase fire equipment, but truly a cost savings. So we brought that kind of circled around to maybe there was some calls for service metrics out to the school or something that we could speak to. And we had some conversations. Maybe the chief can address how often they get called out to the school and existing staff are responding to that.
Right. And to be sure, in response to your question, that's a difficult one. However, the reality is that I can't really afford a school resource officer because we're down to bare minimums in terms of our deployment of our officers. So that officer that was previously in the SRO program was reassigned back to patrol. And I am down one officer because we had an officer earlier in June that did not make probation. So in reality, that analysis and those impacts of cost savings, we don't have the position, we don't have the funding, so we respond to calls at the schools, work with the school administration as we can. We're planning active shooter training and school safety programs and all of those things, but we do not have a presence on the school campuses.
And I think in our discussion, just to reiterate, we were all supportive of the SRO at the previous contribution rates. What the concern was the school was no longer funding their portion, and we felt we couldn't double the contribution with all the other challenges. So I think I really appreciate this information you gave us, and we can look over it prior to the meeting. We're supportive. Can we take on someone else's contribution?
Yeah, I would just like to add to that with respect to San Luis Coastal Unified School District, that while the students are on school property, the students are entrusted to their care, and they need to demonstrate some willingness to contribute to to a school resource officer. And I asked the chief before we met today, do we really know? I've never looked at the school district budget to know to what extent the school district is funding a school resource officer at San Luis High or at Los Osos Middle School, in which case that would be the Sheriff's Department, that would help offer some context to us as to whether, you know, it's neither here nor there right now because we've elected to not fund, you know, to not fund 100%. We want to see the district come up with 50%. But I'm wondering if they're coming up with 50% in San Luis Obispo or coming up with 50% over at Los Osos Middle School. I'm just throwing that out there. You know, before we should, you know, even consider going back to 50%, we have to consider two things. First of all, the students are entrusted to the care of the district while they're on the school property. And second, what are they doing in those other two schools? So, you know, I'll just leave it at that. I do want to offer some perspective there. And if I may, just very quickly, I want to compliment you, Chief, for what your department is doing under some really challenging circumstances. Every interaction I've had with your officers has been positive. It's been constructive. In the last 2 days, just in my neighborhood, I've noticed just officers doing their work and of a preventative, proactive nature, noticing that there was a gate off the hinge and kind of looked like it could have been a break-in. Today, there was an officer got out of his car and was checking a car that was parked all along the side of the road, in, you know, kind of blocking traffic in an awkward way and trying to determine, well, what the heck is that car doing there? So, I mean, they're out there, they're doing their jobs, and you're to be complimented for it because they're so conscientious.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I did want to add some context to the school resource officer position, and we talked about measures. How do you measure the effectiveness? Having been a former DARE officer in Los Angeles, and you all remember that program, so many of those measures of effectiveness are difficult sometimes to quantify, because the reality is the connections that the officers make, the intervention with parents and school officials, the recognizing issues before they become problems, those things are very, very difficult to quantify when you talk about the benefits of a program like this. So I just wanted to add that context and perspective. And the school resource officer is a great program, obviously one that I would like to have. My reality is that I'm down an officer, so I need kind of all hands on deck, and that's where I'm at now. Thank you for your time. Sorry.
Two question comments, and you've got an advisor over here for my second one. I would like to put the concern here as a question. Do you know how the SROs are funded, at least in San Luis Obispo County? I mean, the example today was, the SRO was a SWAT guy, so he was able to be pretty effective. But right. If you could find out, in just San Luis Obispo County, it's not looked nationwide or even right. California, but if you could answer that question, to the extent, quite frankly, that if in other schools the city, like in San Luis Obispo, is the city funding the SRO or is the school district? You don't know, but if you could find out. The other issue, looking at your stats here, is the other sort of national hot button issue, and that's narcotic offenses. And this is, again, like I said, you've got a chief expert over here in the corner. If you look at the numbers here, that one is perceptibly up. Is that an anomaly, or is that just a nationwide trend that goes along with the opioid crisis? And opioids may be putting an umbrella over a lot of narcotic issues. Right. But is that what we're seeing here? Is this a reflection of the national trend? And I don't know, and how would you respond to how that's going to impact? You talked about taking people in and losing 4 or 5 hours. Is that going to exacerbate going forward?
It will. This is an uphill battle that's being experienced nationwide. As we know, that particular problem touches every age bracket, but certainly it has an impact in the schools. To your earlier question about Paso Robles, they actually do not have a school resource officer. They are reaching out to those of us who have or had school resource officers for information on having one based on obviously the recent incidents. So there are some schools in the county that were, as we were, the school resource officer went away, and then there are yet others that are trying to get school resource officers based on current events.
I can tell you I was in a school district in the late 70s that had a SRO. It was a very effective. He was only there half a day. He even taught a class. Right. And I did some research generally over this issue. And it appears to be, in most cases, it's funded jointly, but not all cases. There's some very affluent districts or where maybe the whole thing is funded by the county or, it was a little bit all over the map. But generally speaking, it was around the, from what I could gather, around the 50%, type thing. So the other question would be maybe the school district could be proactive and maybe look for some grants as you've been successful in the fire and that and try to find some help that way if it's an issue.
But I think...
Go ahead, Dawn.
Well, all due respect, I don't think it's the job of this committee to play tit for tat with the school district. I think it's the job of this committee to be thinking about the safety or the finances. Really, our job is the finances, but the chief is here, so we happen to be talking safety, to be thinking about in the context of our city and not being, I don't know that it's our job to say, well, we want to know what the school district does before we'll do X. I would like us to be thinking about what's important for our city, and if without the SRO, if there's a rise in crime in that age level, or if there's less prevention with that age level, then we can be thinking about that in terms of what we control. We don't really have control of what the school district does. It's my impression that being a government agency, the school district's budget would be accessible to the public. I don't, so that's a piece of that. But I would just urge for us to be thinking about how can we have an effect with our own police department as opposed to this back and forth. And the reason I bring it up now is we've had this conversation ongoing, and it feels like, well, unless the school district does X, then we're not going to do Y. And I'm not sure we should be operating from that point of view.
I have a couple of questions before the chief leaves.
Go ahead.
You're down an officer that didn't make probation. Do you have funding in the current year budget to replace that officer?
No.
Okay. How would you see Measure Q funds being able to help with your staffing problems? And has the police department considered starting a reserve officer program where you have part-time officers available to supplement staffing?
I'll answer your first question first about the Measure Q impact or potential impact. There are many, many possibilities, of course, but in the future, perhaps in better fiscal times, perhaps Measure Q would consider financing an additional officer or two, dreaming. And then we would have the ability to perhaps put one in the school, but allowing us to get that second position back eventually would certainly impact our ability to protect the community. But I really do have to do kind of a first things first, back to basics thing at this point. Your second issue about reserve officers is equally challenging for police and fire, and a little different for police though, because they have to maintain a certain level of training before their line reserve officers, which would mean that they can go out and work alongside an officer and perform law enforcement duties. So that's a very difficult challenge. I was a reserve coordinator for LAPD, and finding those people who would normally want to do that as a second career and then go back to what would amount to 9 months training, kind of a prolonged six-month academy, is a difficult challenge. And most people who would do the reserve type duty would now be those same individuals who would get that training at Allen Hancock or another college academy and just become a police officer. So, and then you have to look at also the demographics. This is an older community, and it's harder to find somebody who may be a successful business person, but, you know, at some point I always wanted to be a police officer and go back and commit that time. So it's difficult.
Any other questions for? Thank you. Excellent
Thank you.
Presentation.
Thank you so
really
much.
Appreciate it.
So the public works director is going to talk a little bit. There were some questions on some of the new pavement materials being used, and he can speak to that. I think it's important to clarify that, you know, as we're going into budget, we're really looking at there isn't adequate funding to add positions. There isn't adequate funding to add positions, to add new things. So that's a challenge for all departments. And, and you know, I feel the police department when they say they're down a position, but they have their funded positions filled, but they lost a person, and that feels like a position. So it creates problems. It would create problems in finance. You know, I completely am sympathetic to that. But realistically, for all the departments, I don't see a lot being added to the budget. We're looking at how we can be creative with the money we have. So, Rob, if you want to talk about your pavement.
Sure.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Rob Liva here to talk about trying not to get that ink spot in the shirt pocket, retract the pen, not look like the typical engineer walking around with that ink spot there. Measure Q is funded along with a couple other funding sources, about $6.7 million in street work over the past few years. Those other funding sources include our urban highway, state highway account funds, a formula-based fund that's delivered through SLOCOG, some excess general fund, our grant funding, and then some competitive regional state highway account funds. Last year we reconstructed, or 2 years ago, reconstructed a portion of South Bay Boulevard with that money. Over the past few years, we've worked on approximately 25 of our 53 miles, centerline miles of street, and increased the PCI from, or pavement condition index, from 63 to 66. Anything below 70, state considered that pavement at risk. The trend of our PCI would indicate that we could be at about a 56 average PCI citywide by 2026 if funding levels are not increased. We have employed alternative techniques to street work. I grew up in a world of thin overlays, or first slurry seals every 5 years, thin overlays, overlays, grind, or gut and reconstruct. Cost comparison, about $87 a yard to reconstruct a road in last year's dollars. We pay between $4 and $8 a yard for these alternative sealing techniques that we use. I think you're buying us anywhere between 2 and 10 years time frame on our streets. I know many of you have heard this story before. Most of Morro Bay streets were not built as streets. They evolved. They were county dirt roads that became red rocked, that when upon incorporation were sealed, and then an overlay happened, but the existing base of the road wasn't built as a street. So I think we've made good use of the Measure Q money. We had a rough start to begin with. We didn't spend very much of it, and then have been working to find the best expenditure plan. But this isn't unique to Morro Bay. This is happening statewide and nationwide. We have an aging infrastructure that we haven't funded. Construction costs are rising. There's increased regulatory requirements. We have a reduced purchasing power due to increased construction costs. Everybody's budget's constrained. And then you have the impact on the streets themselves. Increased traffic, heavier traffic. We have higher fuel efficiency in our vehicles now. And our street funding is typically based on the gas tax. And we need to accommodate all the users. You know, we're not just the car. It's pedestrians, bicycles, and buses. Now, there's some bright spots with funding. Last year, the legislature and governor signed SB1, which added this year, it was a partial year, $61,000 to our pavement plan, and we got to do Andros and another street in North Morro Bay. But the first full year of funding will add in excess of $200,000, which typically we do about $500,000 for Measure Q. So I think it's a significant increase to the amount of paving. We will continue to leverage the rubberized pavement grant. Our urban state highway account, the formula-based money for maintenance, and continue to apply for any other available grant funding. With that, I'll answer any questions that you might have or attempt to answer any questions you might have.
Go ahead, John.
Rob, do your crews do a lot of their own road maintenance, or is it all pretty much contract work?
So our crews can do patching, potholing, crack sealing, berm repair fairly well. When we go to street paving, we just don't have the equipment to pave an entire street. We don't have a paver, so we would need to hire a contractor with a paver, not just a piece of equipment. We can go down to United and rent. We do a halfway decent job with a Leighton box on the back of our skip and drag to when we tried to pave before, but it's still not the same thing as using a paving machine.
And is that what the skid steer is used for?
Skid steer is used for, it has a grinder on the front of it and a sweeper, so it's used for prep work ahead of any paving.
Go ahead, John.
I remember that we had a conversation about was there a possibility of sharing the ownership of a paver, and I think your response to that was there some legal requirements which preclude us from sharing ownership of equipment. Is that true?
I don't remember if that I don't know the answer to that question. I know that we've talked to the county several times about sharing expertise in various areas where we might be able to pothole and crack fill. They have actual paving equipment, so to share resources and contract internally for that amount. I used to work for a county in Southwest Washington, and that was our standard practice. Is the county was big enough that the smaller cities just contracted with us for their road maintenance operations. Our county has a multitude of road maintenance equipment and does quite a bit of their own work in-house. There hasn't been a lot of desire on the county standpoint to take on additional work. I think their plate is pretty full, though.
Rob, I have a couple questions to make sure. I've always heard you say that the PCI index of 70 was the goal or standard. It wasn't necessarily, it was like acceptable, minimal acceptable level if all your streets were at a pavement index of 70. Is that correct?
That's what the CTC, yeah. California Transportation Commission, has set as a goal statewide. It's anything below 70 is kind of pavement at risk. 70 and above is you're in fairly good shape.
Mm-hmm. Just so people understand, 70 doesn't mean all brand new streets.
No, it means an average of 70. You may have some in the 60s and some in the 80s. Just an example, Mr. Sauerwine, when he was here, he did some calculations with our pavement management software and calculated to get and maintain a average of 70 in town, we would need to spend an additional $1.7 million per year in addition to our approximately $500,000 Measure Q allocation, or about $2.2 million a year
to get every street at 70.
To achieve that PCI of 70. If we do nothing, we will, in 20 years, we will be at a PCI of in the low 20s, below the 26, if we're spending that $500,000 a year. $500,000 a year right now is about keeping our nose above the lapping high tide.
So the 500K just keeps us even with where we are? Is that what you're saying?
Or and it will, but it will start to
degrade
time, because...
Yeah.
As I started my story about the way streets were built, those streets will end up failing because ceiling over the top of a street that was not built as a street only buys you some time. You can see that on, I think this first street that we did a triple layer on was Tide, and we can see those failures coming back through, and that was 4 years ago.
So you said 63. Is that what the average is of the city streets now, the PCI?
63 was where we were at a few years ago. We brought that up to a 66 by doing these advanced techniques. But we'll plateau, and then we'll start to degrade over time unless we change our methods, and which requires more funding.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I don't see a real good way to, given the current budget situation, to do anything what we're doing right now.
My comment to start with is that I think, quite frankly, you've got an example where you did do a really good job from the year before to this last, and it had to do with bringing the A team instead of the B team to do the roads. I mean, the quality that I kind of casually observed 2 years ago versus what was recent was substantially different, and with the same capital outlay to some extent. So, in other words, there are ways to be creative. John brought up a concept. I mean, saying that somebody's not interested isn't the way we should go. I mean, if we can share equipment with the county, Cayucas, Cambria, we all have the same issues. Are there other creative techniques? I know what about road repair, but as I said, just by bringing an A team in, someone who is more qualified, we got a better product that will probably last longer. So my suspicion is there may be opportunities or different techniques, different approaches that are more long term, not to fix it now, such that Ponderosa is not going to complain so much, but is there sharing equipment? I mean, I think that's a great idea. And that may not be one that will work, but I think thinking that way, if it were my own money, would I continue just plodding along, or would I think more long term, you know, such as what we need to be doing with the leaks in the sewer line? But anyway, I guess I offer to you are there other ways to make better use of the money over time, such that in 10 years, this index is at 0.7, not at 0.5, with the same spending level.
That's not what the predictive model would indicate, that we would need to do some major reconstruction to do that work. Now, I think the driver on pavement is the material, the cost. It's an oil-based product. We've seen, when I started with the city, asphalt was $75, $80 a yard. We're paying right now close to $200 a yard for raw asphalt, not placed. Go to the yard and pick it up. That is the one of the drivers on the cost of road reconstruction is that bare cost of materials. Labor has gone up also. I think we could get creative in doing some of this own work by sharing equipment. Haven't given up on that. I think maybe more viable is to continue to work with when the new county public works director comes in, to work with them about sharing labor forces and equipment and contracting with the county to maybe do some additional work. I've seen that work in other places.
John had a comment, I think. Did you?
Yeah, I had another question. Walking around during my afternoon constitutionals, I noticed some base failures and stuff like that. Would there be any point in getting the appropriate equipment so that we could repair base failures?
We do have equipment to, we could do base failure repairs, so, you know, patching a small area. So we have backhoe. We can saw cut, dig out, place base, repair that. A lot of it comes down to, you know, staffing resources also. We only have so many guys on the streets, consolidated maintenance. They're spread. They're doing building maintenance. They're cleaning bathrooms, and they're doing street repairs. I've been told that back in the 80s and 90s, there was a seven-person streets crew, and we owned our own paving equipment, and they were busy every day doing overlays around town. With two people on a streets crew, you can barely do pothole repairs.
What would you, if you were going to bring somebody on to do something more, do you think there might be any cost savings to have some, you know, quick repair of the failures rather than waiting for the contract every year or two?
So we, you know, through our work order program, do those pothole repairs, dig out and repairs, and I think it would take a fairly significant investment in human resources to, we would need to add probably a couple more bodies to the crews to kind of keep up with those base failures. And I, quite honestly, I don't see that happening in the next couple of years, adding additional staffing.
Thank you.
Just a point of clarification, Rob. Would you say some of that $200 a yard cost for asphalt has to do with the amount that is being currently purchased to do patching versus, you know, if you had a much larger job, would that cost per yard come down?
Slightly. There's limited suppliers on asphalt. There's Union and there's Hansen. They can kind of set the cost. We can't buy it in quantities like Caltrans does. In fact, when Caltrans does a job, you can forget about buying any asphalt because they'll tie up the plants for during their paving season for weeks at a time. You're not buying any asphalt at all.
The Mud Creek repair has wiped out the rock supply in Central Valley. Not just the Central Coast, but I mean in San Joaquin Valley, it's wiped out the supply there too.
Yeah. Well, if that's the case, then, you know, perhaps there would be some opportunities for some cooperative purchasing, a consortium just based on what the county does, that we could participate for our part of it in that. I mean, you know, I'm tossing it out there.
Yeah.
It's all time. It's all effort. I mean,
I definitely
and
agree.
And it may not be practical, but, you know, that's definitely, you know, maybe worth thinking about.
I think we have to look at different ways of doing things. You know, all these are great ideas, and we'll run them as far as we can to, you know, see different ways to, spend the people's money wisely.
Okay. Anything else? Or we can move on. Go ahead, John.
So, Rob, is your plan then to do the major paving work every 2 years or every year?
When Mr. Sauerwein was here, he brought to us a kind of innovative way of contracting that I wasn't used to in local government, the indefinite quantity, indefinite delivery method, which he was used to in the federal government, where you bring a contractor on board for a multi-year contract. We have pavement coatings, a contractor on board for another year that we would, it saves some on mobilization, but we have fixed costs and we have fixed escalation, negotiated escalation amount. So we know what those ceiling costs are going to be next year so we can plan better. With this IDIQ process. Now, we don't have an IDIQ process for pavement. We haven't done much paving in the last couple of years. We've done seal coating, triple layers, but a different type of contractor would do that paving, and we should look at the IDIQ concept with a paving contractor also, to lock in those prices so that we can kind of guarantee that certainty.
I guess my point was, are we looking at having $500,000 holdover to the next year to do 2 years worth of work in one fiscal year? Is that going to be your approach, or are you going to use $500,000 per year?
I think that's the advantage of the IDIQ contract, is you have that contractor locked in for multiple years, and you don't have to rely upon building up a fund and only doing it once every 2 years.
And the other point that goes along with that is the Measure Q has increased in the past few years significantly.
Yes.
It was originally several years ago in the $700,000. Now it exceeds $1 million. So some years, remember, we started that every other year. We were only putting $350,000, $400,000. Wasn't enough. So couple that increase, couple the additional $200,000 that you'll get from the SB1 and some fuel tax money. And I think that gives, with your contract, gives you a significant boost that you can do something every year without paying huge setup, fixed price setup costs.
And just one last, hopefully this won't elicit too many more comment or questions, but you know, the street maintenance isn't the only draw upon you know, kind of our gas tax funds. There's other things in the street that we need to maintain: curbs, gutters, sidewalks, street trees, storm drainage. You know, all gets kind of all draws from that same pot of money. And then if we want any betterments in the city, like we need to make some sort of improvements to the 41 Main Highway 1 intersection, and unfortunately haven't been able to convince the state of California so far that they need to be a major player in that game too.
Rob, one more. Sorry.
Sure.
One of the things that members of this committee noted was that over the years, Measure Q has paid very little in the way of storm drain maintenance. What is your opinion of the need in that area?
We have a fairly small underground storm drain system, not like other cities where there's almost a separate sewer system. Our storm drainage is mainly surface. Until you get down near the bay, then it goes subsurface and into the water. The storm drain system that we do have out there is 50-year-old corrugated metal pipe. I think it's we're doing an assessment that right now with as part of our One Water plan, and we'll have a capital program. I don't think we'll have anywhere near the funding that's needed for that capital program. Most of the corrugated metal pipe that I've looked at, maybe only the top half still exists. It's a tunnel through the soil. And you can see evidence of that. The latest one we found was on Quintana Road at about where the auto repair places are on the kind of the easterly section of Quintana Road. You'll see a hole developing there, and that's from the backfill going down into the pipe there. So we need to get in there and replace a section of that pipe. But that is another piece of infrastructure because of the materials that were used, and, you know, great materials, but they don't last forever.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you, Rob.
Okay. Sorry for all the good news.
No apologies necessary. It's interesting. Very good. Jen, what are you looking for from us on the preparation of the Measure Q, or was this, are you going to give us an A list, B list, or?
So we haven't done lists yet.
Okay.
The revenue estimates that we have from HDL, our sales tax consultant, are $1,055,000.
Okay.
So we wanted to, there's been lots of questions on some of the work that's been done that I haven't been able to answer. So part of this was informational. Part of it was an opportunity for you to hear the needs of the department. Mm-hmm. And then the last part was if you would like to give any guidance as we prepare the A and B list and prepare what we bring forward in April, we're happy to hear that and, and consider that when we're developing the budget.
Well, I think the guidance would be somewhat consistent with past years. Obviously, the fire station, the debt service, that $90,000, I think that's, we don't really have any alternatives for that. And the fourth firefighter to maintain the response call, that we've pretty much always done without question. And then the remaining items typically have been more what kind of equipment's needed, how much, you know, we need for pavement management. Yeah. I think all three gentlemen have made a very good case for all of their requests. So I guess I would ask you to solicit requests from the departments and prioritize it. And if you want our input, I'm sure we'd be happy to give it, you know.
So that'll come in April with the proposed.
Okay.
You'll hear that. We just wanted to give you an advance
as
we work towards this more collaborative kind of, you know, thing. If there was something specific you wanted to see or did not want to see or want to recommend, we wanted to know that before we prepared the budget.
Have you been having discussions about creative ways to plug holes and possibly using Measure Q funds?
There's kind of general conversations, and they haven't been specific with Measure Q yet, but as we look at our donation accounts, as we look at Measure Q as some of the safety grant accounts that we have, what qualifies for expenditures that we can charge to those to kind of relieve the general fund.
Have there been discussions of changing the percentage of allocations between the various departments?
No, not yet.
Thank you.
In general, we have said that it will go for the police, fires, safety, storm drain, and the only labor costs, which were presented before council years ago, were on the fourth firefighter and the school resource officer. There were no other labor costs. So I think our direction would be we don't want to be using Measure Q to backfill, you know, general administrative expenses in terms of labor that if you have to cut in any of the departments, you know, to meet your goals, you have to make some hard decisions. And I don't think we'd want to be using Measure Q to backfill those difficult decisions. We want to use Measure Q for the intention of the ballot initiative.
I should have asked this when the fire chief was here, but I'm wondering if he's expecting any kind of uptick in disaster response and therefore an uptick in funding needed for disaster response. I think we're starting to see that across communities of California, and how Measure Q might play into that would be just something I'd be interested in getting his take on that I didn't think of while he was here.
Okay.
Okay, good point. A lot of that's funded, hopefully, but, you know, through other agencies. I see we're running out of time, Jennifer, so I need to, you know, do a quick time. I believe, is there a meeting in here at 6 or 6:30?
Six.
Okay, so we need to wrap this up in 8 minutes. Number five, yeah. We're not going to get to number four, I don't think, although we included some of that comments in our discussion when the gentlemen were presenting. But just real quickly, we probably won't have any subcommittee updates. I know ours doesn't, so, and Dave, doesn't it, this time. So on item number 5, the second quarter investment report, that's only one quick page. I think John wanted to make a comment on that, and I reviewed it also in general concurrence with your recommendation. Go ahead, John.
Well, just I think generally your recommendation on the liquidity, I think that's fine. Mm-hmm. I still would wonder about the amount that you have in the Rabobank accounts. I think we had mentioned that last time, because they really are so low interest. I know those are pretty much operating accounts. At least the sweep account should be an operating account. Is there a way to integrate those more efficiently with LAIF so that there's more money kept in LAIF and less money kept locally?
Yes, as the last couple CDs have matured and I haven't done anything with them, you know, they've kind of sat in Rabobank. That's not the best practice. You're absolutely right. So we'll work towards that 65% to 70% liquidity rate once we take this to council, and then keep more in LAIF and less in Rabobank going forward.
Okay, so you're already above the 65% to 75%. It looks like 83%. Okay. And I think you mentioned that in your staff report. Yes, some of these retired, you would look at them. And okay.
Yes.
Any other comments on the investment report? Is that satisfy your? Yeah. Okay. All right. Then that brings us pretty close to the future agenda items. I think we'll Jennifer, we can work on that. Yeah. For our April meeting, we have that scheduled for Wednesday, April 25th.
So that was a change from the regularly scheduled meeting, and that was in order to give you a more comprehensive proposed budget. We should have that more finalized by then, so that would be the primary focus of that meeting.
Okay, so that's the last week of the month. That's on a Wednesday, same time, this location. Everybody agreeable to that? All right, any other closing comments before we adjourn? It's the 25th, Wednesday. Okay, I'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you. 25th, Wednesday.
Bailing out?
Well, I don't blame you.
I was here for the...
I know, I've got the jetpack. You can only one edit on...
Not for your life to work.
Oh, that's no good.
What?
I don't know if I'll answer all his questions, but I'm able to talk to him.
So you see how they actually reflect. Yeah.
We're just trying to break it up a little bit.
Yeah. I didn't make the case. I guess you'd have to kind of know the circumstances.
So I think pretty much this was our
what the city did. Yeah.
Now, if you have questions or concerns, you could probably talk to Jennifer. Okay. So, I mean, it was more than a year, obviously, but everybody knows.
Uh-huh.
And as far as I suggest that you
Yeah.
It's
going to be. I'll be interested in the whole design. Design goes a different set of rules.
Yeah.
Contacting the.
So who's managing payment? Is it just you right now, or are you the contact person for payment program now?
Yes. For now.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Probably have.
I think it was kind of long, but it wasn't.
Sure.
But you know what?
Yes.